After 30 years, we do believe that this can now happen.
The Trump administration greenlights the King Cove Road Project. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, January 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, can climate change affect mental health? A new report from the state says yes.
Just talk to some of your friends and neighbors here in Anchorage and just ask them, how do they feel about the last several winters?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Thinking about completing your college degree? Good news, you can finish it right here at the University of Alaska. Go after your dream by earning a bachelor's, master's, a certificate, or an associate degree at the University of Alaska. Flexible classes, convenient schedules, affordable choices, and outstanding faculty, the university has it all. It's your choice, your dream. See how the University of Alaska can help you achieve it at alaska.edu/start here. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
The city of King Cove says it's reached a deal with the Trump administration to build a road through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. King Cove residents argue they need the road to access the all-weather airport in Cold Bay. But environmental groups believe it would ruin critical wildlife habitat. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Zoe Sobel has more on the deal with the Interior Department.
For the past year, the city of King Cove has been working with the Trump administration to find a way to build a road through the refuge. Now, City Administrator Gary Hennig says they have reached an agreement with the Interior Department for a land swap between the King Cove Corporation and the federal government. He expects the deal to be signed January 22nd in Washington, D.C.
The whole community is excited simply because after 30 years, we do believe that this can now happen.
King Cove residents say they need the road because bad weather can leave people stranded during medical emergencies. But the 12-mile gravel road would pass through what is now designated wilderness, the highest level of conservation given to federal lands.
Eisenbeck's Lagoon Complex is a globally important ecosystem that contains one of the largest eelgrass beds in the world.
Nicole Whittington Evans, Alaska Regional Director of the Wilderness Society.
There is no question that building a road through the isthmus of this lagoon's complex will have significant impacts.
The Wilderness Society will challenge the agreement in court along with other environmental groups. Whittington Evans says she thinks they will have a good case.
There have been prior land exchanges that have been deemed unlawful by the courts, and we will be reviewing everything that this agreement puts together.
In 2013, former Interior Secretary Sally Jewell rejected the idea of the road, saying it would cause irreparable harm to the refuge and the wildlife that depend on it. But Hennig isn't worried about legal battles with environmental groups.
We have known that that is going to be there. It's always been there. We are comfortable in believing that once it's known what the agreement has in it, we are very confident that we will prevail.
The Interior Department didn't respond to a request for comment. Once the deal is signed, Hennig believes it will take up to 6 months to study the best route for the road and appraise the land. Then Hennig says King Cove will be looking to the state of Alaska to fund construction of the road, estimated at $22 million. In a best-case scenario, he says the road would be completed by 2020. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Onalaska.
How will climate change affect health in Alaska? Dangerous travel conditions could cause more accidents, warmer temperatures could spread new diseases, and the topsy-turvy weather could worsen mental health. Those are some conclusions from a new state report released today. Rachel Waldholtz from Alaska's Energy Desk has more.
The report from the State Health Department tries to predict the effects if current climate forecasts hold true. Sarah Yoder is the lead author. She says she was a little taken aback by what they found.
The surprise was just how broad exactly all these potential health impacts are.
Impacts from infrastructure damage to new diseases. The report notes that thawing permafrost can disrupt water and sewer lines, undermine health clinics, and damage roads, making access to healthcare and basic sanitation more difficult. Thinner sea and river ice can make travel and subsistence hunting more dangerous. more wildfires can worsen air quality. Warmer temperatures could allow the spread of insects carrying Lyme disease or the West Nile virus. These are all predictions for the future. But state epidemiologist Joe McLaughlin says the future may already be here.
We may, in fact, be already seeing some impacts of climate change here in Alaska. But the challenge is that many of these potential impacts have not been well studied and definitively linked to climate change.
Then there are the impacts on mental health, like solastalgia. If you're saying, "Sola what?" you are not alone. McLaughlin says he hadn't heard the term before the research for this report. But when he did stumble across it, he says he found it kind of perfect.
When I describe to people in my community, people that I know, sort of I help them put a word to what they're feeling, and they say, yeah, that's it. That's what I feel.
The report describes solastalgia as the sense of loss people experience because of unwanted environmental changes to their homes, disorienting shifts that can lead to anxiety and depression. So, okay, but is it real?
Just talk to some of your friends and neighbors here in Anchorage and just ask them how do they feel about the last several winters.
Or on the more severe end, it can define the stress for an entire community facing relocation. Ultimately, McLaughlin says climate change is a different kind of public health challenge than, say, a mumps outbreak.
This is going to be a marathon, so you have to look at this more as a marathon and not a sprint.
He says the impacts of climate change will unfold over decades, but the time to start planning is now. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz in Anchorage.
Republican gubernatorial hopeful and Wasilla resident Mike Dunleavy is resigning from the state Senate to focus on campaigning. For the past 5 years, Dunleavy has represented Senate District E, which includes northern parts of the Matanuska-Susitna borough and a section stretching from Delta Junction to Valdez. But today, Dunleavy submitted his letter of resignation. Dunleavy recently restarted his campaign for governor after suspending it to get treatment for an issue with his heart. Dunleavy says that took time away from planning the campaign, but with his health concerns resolved, he says he now needs to put all his energy into running for governor.
I've always been one to put 100% into whatever I'm doing, and so the choice is either run for governor and give 100% or stay with the Senate and give 100%, and we felt we couldn't do both.
Dunleavy's resignation from the state's Senate is set for January 15th. That's the day before the legislature starts its next session. State law restricts fundraising by sitting lawmakers while the legislature is in session. Dunleavy admits the resignation will make it easier for him to fundraise, but he says he owes it to his constituents and Alaskan voters in general to focus on the campaign.
The last 3 years have demonstrated that we have an absence of leadership. People need to ask themselves, is Alaska better off the past 3 years than previous to this? And wherever I go, the answer is no.
It's now up to the state Republican Party to suggest possible replacements for Dunleavy's Senate seat. Those names go to the governor, who will appoint the next state senator for District E, pending approval by Senate Republicans. Dunleavy says he does not want to be involved in the process of picking his successor and declined to name anyone he'd like to see take his spot in the Senate. Meanwhile, Matsu Borough Assemblyman Randall Kowalki is the only candidate to formally announce he is running for Senate District E. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the sled dog race season gets underway in South Central.
I have all my young dogs here today. A lot of them have never raced before.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
U.S. cross-country ski nationals wrapped up in Anchorage today. Alaskans dominated the top spots on the podium. Alaska Public Media's Emily Russell was at the races and sent this report.
So we're here at the Kincaid Ski Trails, and the place is completely buzzing with people. It's a little below freezing, but the sun is shining and Denali is out on the horizon. Skiers from across the country are here because it's one of the last chances to qualify for the upcoming Olympics.
So we have people, you know, skiing small laps around the stadium, vying for Olympic spots, and it doesn't get any more exciting than that.
And Holly Brooks would know.
I'm a two-time Olympian went to Vancouver and Sochi. And here at the Olympic Trials, I am Joint Chief of Awards with my husband, Rob Whitney.
Brooks qualified for the Vancouver Olympics the last time these races were in Anchorage in 2010. Another Alaskan seems to be following in her footsteps.
My name is Caitlin Patterson, and I'm a cross-country ski racer.
Patterson skis professionally out of Vermont.
But I went to high school here in Anchorage, Alaska.
And on her home turf, Patterson swept the women's podiums.
I set out with high expectations for myself for this championship, but this has been above and beyond.
The women's team heading to the Olympics next month is incredibly competitive and even has the potential to medal for the first time ever. Unless she qualifies in World Cup races later this month, it'll be up to the coach's discretion whether Patterson makes the Olympics or not.
And I'm crossing my fingers hoping that they'll actually take someone from this domestic trials.
Caitlin's brother Scott likely has his fingers crossed as well. Scott won the men's distance skate race by more than a minute last week, helping his chances at being chosen to go to South Korea in February. Another sibling duo from Alaska also inched closer to their Olympic dreams. Logan and Reese Hahnemann are from Fairbanks and now ski for Alaska Pacific University in Anchorage. Reese won the skate sprint race on Friday, and his younger brother Logan recorded the fastest time of the day during the qualifiers, which helps his chances at becoming an Olympian. And it was a sprint to the finish that narrowly nabbed another national championship for Anchorage's Tyler Cornfield on Sunday.
This race today, I could never have dreamed. I mean, I've dreamed this, but the way it happened and the community here, it's unbelievable. I'm just so excited.
Cornfield is more of a sprinter.
It's all about being smart for us big sprinters and just trying to wait until the last moment. And when we do, just hammer as hard as we can and hope no one comes around us.
And no one did. Cornfield shared the podium with fellow Anchorage skier Eric Packer, who finished less than a second behind Cornfield. The Olympic nominations are expected in late January, and after these races, it's almost certain that Alaskans will be on that list. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Emily Russell.
The sled dog racing season for 2018 kicked off in South Central over the weekend with the Joe Reddington Senior Kinnick 200. This year, the race was not run near Kinnick, but had to be moved to Willow due to trail conditions. KTNA's Philip Manning was there for the start and has the story.
The Joe Reddington Senior Kinnick 200 began on Saturday morning at Deshka Landing in Willow. In temperatures hovering around zero, 28 mushers were poised to set off on their first race of the season. Robert Sexton, race manager for the Kinnick 200, explains why the race began in Willow as opposed to Kinnick. He says it all comes down to trail conditions after a December thaw.
A lot of the mushers, even in the Willow area, we were actually losing in the 40s too. So a lot of the teams were getting trained as such. And then down in the Kinnick area, they were still on four-wheelers up until about 3 weeks ago.
While much of South Central saw significant snowfall last week, including Kinnick, Sexton says the decision had already been made to run from Deshka Landing. Race judge Dee Dee Johnrow approves of the race committee's decision to move the start for safety reasons. Johnrow is a well-known advocate for dog safety and care and has won multiple awards for her treatment of dogs during her career. She says races like the Kinnick 200 are good learning opportunities, especially for less experienced mushers.
It's important to get these qualifier races available so that the drivers can learn things. You know, you really only learn by doing. And so we've done all of our seminars and all of the talks and rookie meetings and such. And now it's really nice that the committee put it together such that they're able to get out on the trail and test their skills.
One musher who hoped to gain valuable experience in the Kinnick 200 is Ellen King. Ellen is the daughter of four-time Iditarod champion Jeff King and is well on her way to qualifying for the Iditarod as well. King says racing with her father's dogs is analogous to driving a Cadillac. Saturday's race start was also Ellen King's 26th birthday, and her goal for the race was simply to get herself and her team through the course safely.
10 fingers, 10 toes for me, and to get everybody around and around happy and healthy.
Talkeetna musher Anya Radano's team was next to Ellen King's in the preparation area. Radano has already qualified for this year's Iditarod, and her goal was to train her team and work on deciding which dogs will accompany her as she attempts the run to Nome in March.
I have all my young dogs here today, and a lot of them have never raced before, so this is just to introduce them to the craziness of a race start and races and other dog teams and camping and stuff like that, and so like we'll hopefully figure some more facts out.
See who makes the cut.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Both King and Radano finished the race, and Anya says she's very pleased with her team. Ellen King was close to breaking into the top 10 on her run. Further ahead in the pack, Nicholas Petit won the Kinnick 200. Petit could figure to be a major competitor in this year's Iditarod after finishing third last year. Other notable top 10 finishes included Ray Reddington, Lance Mackey, and Scott Jansen. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Eastern Orthodox churches across Alaska celebrated Christmas yesterday, following the Julian calendar. KDLG's Avery Lill visited St. Seraphim of Sarov Orthodox Church in Dillingham and has more on the celebration and the tradition of starring.
Slavi begins right after the Christmas liturgy. Five people stand in front of the church, spinning five brightly colored tinsel and cardboard stars with an icon at the center. The members of the church divide into groups depending on which star represents them. They sing in a mixture of English, Yupik, and Slavonic. There's one star for each of the villages in St. Seraphim's parish: Dillingham, Oleknagik, Portage Creek, and Ekuk. And then there's a great big star. It's 7 feet tall. That one will stay put in the nave of the church, but the others are just starting their Slavi journeys. All three Slavi groups walk over from the church to the parish house with their stars. After singing again there, they share a meal of salmon and ham with the priest and his family. From there, the stars split up. Slavi singers will go from house to house for the rest of the week, following that pattern of singing and sharing food with their hosts. Each star with its singers might go to as many as 10 or 15 houses in a day.
It's like caroling to the extreme and also going into people's homes and proclaiming that salvation has come into the world through the child.
That's St. Seraphim's Reverend Michael Nikolai. Slavi is a tradition that originally comes from Ukraine, and it's celebrated around the state. The stars are symbolic of the star in the Bible that the wise men from the east followed to find the infant Jesus. Traditionally in Alaska, Slavi singers take their stars to other villages by snow machine, or back in the old days, by dog sled. Leona Carr from Portage Creek remembers caroling late into the night as a kid.
We used to Slavi all night long, and it was very tiring. When we fell asleep in a house, they used to leave us, and we'd have to look for them.
With low snow on the ground this year, stars in the St. Seraphim Parish say that they're likely to stick around Dillingham and Oleknagik's road system this year. They'll continue through January 13th. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station.
A boat-to-table seafood processor in Sitka is expanding its retail footprint in the Midwest. Sitka Salmon Shares has just completed a deal to join some other high-end food retailers and manufacturers in a renovated mill in downtown Madison, Wisconsin. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Sitka Salmon Shares resembles community-supported agriculture, but with a twist. Instead of getting deliveries of locally harvested produce from nearby farms, customers in the Illinois and Wisconsin area are getting sustainably harvested salmon from fishermen owners in Sitka. It's the brainchild of Nick Mink, who still teaches food justice at Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois.
I start teaching on Thursday. I'm dreading it. No, I'm super excited, but yes, I only teach part-time now.
That's because the company he started with Port Alexander troller Marsh Skeel 7 years ago with a couple of boats is on its way up to a fleet of 40 with a state-of-the-art processing facility in Sitka and regional packaging and distribution hubs in Galesburg, Chicago, and now Madison.
Specifically, we're going to use this site to grow our distribution footprint in the upper Midwest. So we're planning to use this site to help us make more efficient our distribution into Minnesota, northern Iowa, and Wisconsin.
Mink says Salmon Shares will add about 8 positions in management, sales, and marketing in Madison. The operation will take up a sizable chunk of the 55,000-square-foot historic Garver feed mill, which has been vacant for over 20 years.
It's right in the middle of the city. It has this incredible 100-acre site. It's perfect for kind of light manufacturing. And we became one of the kind of the lead leasors and in the building. And so we'll be there with a kombucha manufacturer, an ice cream manufacturer. So there's going to be about 8 to 10 mid-scale food businesses in this facility once everything is ready to go in about a year.
The growth has brought changes on the back end as well. Salmon Shares co-founder and vice president Marsh Skeel grew up salmon trolling with his parents out of Port Alexander in Sitka. Last season, for the first time, he left his boat tied up and spent much of the summer working on the company's expansion in the Midwest. Skeel attributes the growth of Salmon Shares to growth in demand for good fish. Well, not just a good fish, but a perfect fish, which is what many trollers strive to produce.
And there's no really comparison when you take hook and line in small boat fisheries and you work directly with the fishermen. That's hands down the only way to get really consistently perfect fish.
Skeel is speaking from a hammock at his parents' house on the Baja Peninsula in Mexico. He's taking a break now, but he'll be back to Sitka in February to work on building the roster of Salmon Shares owner fishermen from its current 20 to a planned 40 over the next couple of years. Those who know Skeel don't have to be concerned that he's gone corporate. He's got one sport coat for fancy dinners, but the rest is unchanged.
Marsh, do you wear a coat and tie to work?
No, I don't have a shirt on right now. I don't.
The informal approach is working. The Salmon Shares website tries to make customers feel like participants in Alaska's laid-back fishing culture. Company president Nick Mink says that it's not just about selling fish, but educating consumers about the markets. Next season, with deep restrictions on king salmon likely, that may mean shifting some emphasis to the rockfish jig fisheries in Kodiak, for example, or to an unsung species closer to home.
We're doing a lot right now to educate our members about, the beauty of chum salmon.
Mink says no salmon soaks up a marinade better than chum, and that Midwesterners love to marinade. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
In the summer of 2016, the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly became embroiled in a contentious battle over opening its meetings with prayer. The Assembly put what some consider an unconstitutional policy in place after a member of the Satanic Temple ended an invocation with "Hail Satan." The issue is still winding its way through the courts, but one Homer man is fighting against the invocation policy in a new way, by worshiping the flying spaghetti monster. KBBI's Renee Gross has the story.
Homer resident Barrett Fletcher is preparing to host the first meeting of the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster at his home. He needs the religion to have regular meetings in the area so he can fill the borough's requirement to give an invocation. For Pastafarians, this meeting will be like going to church. Fletcher set out bowls of chocolates and popcorn and is cooking meatballs, white sauce, and of course, lots of spaghetti.
Bubble, toilet, trouble. Oh wait, that's the wrong religion.
It may sound like Fletcher believes religion is a joke, but his feelings about it are often more cynical than that.
I am offended by the Christian religion and their idea of the narcissistic demanding God.
He has a strong conviction that religion and politics should not mix.
The invocation prior just sets my teeth on edge. It just makes me angry, and that's not a good way to do the borough's business.
When a Satanist gave the prayer at a meeting about a year and a half ago, Fletcher thought it was pretty funny. The borough did not. It inspired assembly members to write criteria restricting who can give the invocation. Only members of religious associations that have an established presence in the area or chaplains who work for local organizations like the fire department can get approval. The American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit against this policy, saying it violates free speech and equal protection under the law. Fletcher wants to join in on the opposition, and he knows just the way to do it. He's ordered credentials from the Flying Spaghetti Monster and a rare Pastafarian Bible. At the meeting, he reads the monster's version of the commandments, called the I Really Rather You Didn't.
I'd really rather you didn't judge people for the way they look, or how they dress, or the way they talk, or, well, just play nice, okay?
On December 11th, Fletcher applied to give a borough invocation next fall when the Assembly holds its meeting in Homer. But the Assembly denied his request 4 days later because Pastafarians have an established community presence. Setting out to change that, Fletcher arranged this gathering and posted it on Facebook. Eventually, a few members from the community showed up, but for a while, it was just his girlfriend and his daughter, Iris Fletcher.
I'm here because I live here in this house and wanted dinner. but I think that the whole invocation thing is rather silly.
But others take it more seriously.
Well, it's been in place for 40 years, so it's a tradition in the United States. Why would we not be able to have an invocation?
Wayne Ogle is the president of the Assembly and believes in the invocation. Other Assembly members have attempted many times to repeal it and the rules around it. But Ogle says it only makes sense to have these prerequisites in place.
It's a reasonable requirement, people to have a basic qualification, have a standing in the community to a basis for which they can get up and give an invocation. It's not meant to disqualify a great number of people or anything like that.
Ogle says Fletcher wasn't truthful in his application when he claimed the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster was meeting regularly. If that changed,
then he could reapply, and for all intents and purposes, he probably will be making an invocation.
Fletcher will apply again, and he may join the ACLU case as a plaintiff if he is denied the opportunity for an invocation. The case will pick back up in February. But he said his ultimate goal is not to get his application approved.
I really think it's unfortunate that it's gone this far. To be honest, I don't want to give an invocation. I don't think that public meetings should invoke any gods at all. I would prefer that the invocation policy just be dropped so that the point would become moot.
And in case that doesn't happen,
in the event that we continue to invoke gods at public meetings, I intend to invoke the greatest god of them all, the creator of the universe, the great flying spaghetti monster.
But the spot he applied for has already been taken. On the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly website, it says a pastor from the Alaska Bible Institute will be giving the invocation for the Homer meeting next fall. Reporting in Homer, I'm Renee Gross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website. We had reports tonight from Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, Rachel Waldholtz, Casey Grove, and Emily Russell in Anchorage, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Avery Lill in Dillingham, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Renee Gross in Homer. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.